Right now, it is time to bring in the friends of ours from the Lakeville Journal, Janet Manco and Cynthia Hosswinter. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Nice little surprise, a little bit of snow out there, but we've got more on the way starting around noontime till about noontime tomorrow. So
unpredictable.
It's unpredictable. All right. That's life nowadays, unpredictable. We can all be happy we're not in Texas. You know, we complain about Eversource.
Yeah.
You can really see about a power company to complain in Texas and California. So just hold that in your minds the next time you complain about Eversource.
Yeah. All,
you know, it's really it really is true. We take a lot of things for granted, and we basically our power companies do a pretty good job here and don't fail on a huge capacity like this every 2 or 3 years.
Right. Now, you know, the conditions in Texas now, we think of those conditions as, you know, winter conditions. And, boy, those repair people from Eversource get out there in all kinds of weather, and it's not easy.
Yeah. Let's go right to the front page when we're talking about winter. A nice picture there, a jumper's eye view. Of course, Jump Fest went on as planned. They even streamed it live, and it was successful for them.
I showed up at the Jumps on Saturday just as they reached capacity, and they were nice enough to say we could get in because we were pressed, but I didn't want to take a space from people that really, you know, had planned a day around it. So I went home and watched the live stream, and it was great. Really nicely filmed, and as you know, there's always a lot of downtime between jumps, and it does allow you to go off and make some cocoa or do something. But a lot of people turned out, and I think it was frustrating for the Salisbury Winter Sports Association to have to turn people away, but at the same time, I think they must have been very gratified by the people who, you know, 50 deep were willing to stand in line on, you know, not a horribly cold day, but certainly not warm weather, and wait to get in and take part in the excitement of the annual Jump Fest. And they had great weather conditions. There was no anxiety this year about the snow. It was almost as though the weather said, we know you're worrying about enough stuff. We'll just make sure that there's perfect snow and perfect conditions for you.
So another
successful SWASA Jump Fest.
All right. Right below that, seeing as we're on the winter tone before we go to some other stories, there will be a winter sports season. The CIAC, the Connecticut Health Department, the CDC all got together, and there will be some sort of winter sports season going on for athletes at high school.
And for speaking of people who maybe are not as fully appreciated as they ought to be for the effort they make, Ann McNeil, the athletic director for the high school, but also really for the region at this point, has worked very hard. And it's hard enough to schedule all these matches and all these practices for all the different teams. There's boys teams, there's girls teams, there's buses, there's a lot to organize. And so this year, Ann McNeil is having to really scramble to find places not only for competitions and to work with the other coaches on opportunities for them to play against each other, but also just to find places to practice so that the hockey team is now driving all the way down to Simsbury, which, of course, has the, you know, Olympic-quality rinks down there, which will be a treat. But, you know, pretty nice when you have the Olympic-quality rinks at Salisbury and Hotchkiss available to you, too. So a very interesting story from Hunter Lyle that starts off with him saying, describing the game against the Nanawag Chiefs last week where the students had to stop and take a mask off break to catch their breath. And really, people have given it a lot of thought and come right into this winter season thinking about what's best for the athletes. So Hunter does a nice job describing what the different protocols are going to be for the different sports this year.
All right. And something that I think a lot of people have overlooked, I mean, we have covered, and the high school administration has done an outstanding job, not only here, but all the high schools and all the school districts around us, in coming up with plans and following those plans and keeping school going one way or another. But one thing we don't really focus in on, and you focus in with Patrick Sullivan's story, on how the teachers at Housatonic Valley Regional High School are adapting on a day-to-day, month-to-month basis with COVID-19.
And one of the nice things about having a reporter like Patrick, who's been here for many, many years now and really knows a lot of the people in the community, is there were three teachers that he spoke to who are doing very different styles of teaching and learning, and talked to them about the complexity of sometimes being in the classroom, sometimes being at home. Some of the teachers are only remote, and it's a lot. I mean, again, when you talk about scheduling, and again, Lisa Carter, such a treasure, our new superintendent, it's hard enough to do scheduling when everybody's in the building. But when you've got, you know, the days when the school is open, the days when the school is closed, there's cleaning, there's athletics, there's buses, there's kids that are coming in, there's teachers that are coming in, there are teachers that are not coming in. It's a lot to organize. So Patrick talked to three different teachers about how they're coping. And you're really, you know, not that there would ever be whining, but really no whining. Just like, this is what we're doing, and we're making it work. And what's most important, as Ann McNeil says about winter sports, is let's make sure that this is a great experience for the students.
Yeah, and I give them a lot of credit. It's a tough time for everybody. We know in media, newspapers, radio, any job, it's tough with COVID-19. But teaching, which is such an integral part of, especially the grammar schools, hats off to the teachers. Now let's get some good news in here, and you've got a nice picture of Dino's, and I like that. You got Cynthia, you got him right in the middle of a toss. I think that is really an amazing picture.
Dean is an incredible guy, and actually, you know, thank you for reminding me, because I made a movie of him tossing the dough, and I'll post it on our Instagram today to promote the story of it. Dean is so great and so lovely, and actually longtime hockey coach for Housatonic Valley Regional High School, and just a lovely guy, and one of the many pizza place owners that we have in the area. We had a summer intern once who the first story he wanted to do was, how can a town as small as North Canaan support three pizzerias? And of course, Salisbury, about the same size, also has three pizzerias. So Deb Alexinas did a very funny story, and fascinating actually, about whether Connecticut is going to vote in pizza as its state food. And I looked online, and as far as I could tell, most other states have a fruit or a vegetable as their state food. Like, even New York has their state food, of course, is the apple. And if you look, you know, certain states will have specialty foods. Like, I think in New Orleans there's some kind of a sandwich, not a muffaletta, but something else, or, you know, like jambalaya. There's all sorts of sort of ethnic foods that are of particular, you know, interest and are listed as a state food. So presumably pizza will count as that for Connecticut. But that very funny, called up pizzerias in New York, and of course got their opinion on whether Connecticut has better pizza or not. So really worth reading. And I don't even like pizza that much, and I'll tell you, after you read the story, you're going to definitely be on the phone ordering a pizza from your favorite pizzeria.
Well, what's interesting about the state of Connecticut is that really there is a battle between New York and Connecticut for the first pizzeria, Frank Pepe's, which now his whole family has different pizzerias, Pepe Pizzeria with the same. And when you go down there and you have their pizza, you see that it's not called pizza, it's called tomato pie, and then you add stuff on top of it. But you're right, when you come to our area out in the middle of nowhere, it seems no matter what town you go in, there's a couple pizzerias.
Yeah.
It really is an accepted food in this state, almost like grinders, because grinders are just available everywhere. That's the amazing thing about pizzas. They are available everywhere.
But very little Chinese food in this region. But, you know, as this debate goes on, I'll just say, I'm from Chicago, so, you know, you all can just take a back seat.
Well, then now you've got Detroit-style, Chicago-style.
It's California.
That's right. Who thinks that pizza would be that? Well, anyways, yeah, it's a great story, and Connecticut should have pizza as its state food. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Completely agree.
All right. You've got a story on paying for recycling costs and also Eversource efforts to do better in the future.
Right, and so that's the COG, which is our regional first selectman from 21 towns. And I think, Janet, there's a letter in this week's paper, maybe it's next week's, about the COG.
About
COG. So the COG is a very interesting organization. There's two different parts to it. One is the administration of the COG, which is, you know, within the office in Goshen. But one is just the 21 first selectmen who get together once a month to discuss issues that are of common and then talk about things like grants, because they'll take turns applying for grants depending on who needs the money, and they'll help them with the grant money. So they were talking about recycling and, you know, complexities of that, but also Eversource. And, you know, I would say COVID is a fairly anxious time for all of us. There's a lot of uncertainty, and we're all spending way too much time sitting at home thinking. And one of the things that really bothered people that Eversource did on last August with Tropical Storm Isaias was that they didn't really communicate well to the towns about what was going on, and that made people completely anxious. So one of the things they're vowing to do, and I think that they've, you know, as far as I can tell, they're trying to do a pretty good job this winter, is just to communicate better and give people a better idea of what exactly is going on. Because this is New England. People can cope with a lot. They just kind of want to know, you know, how long is it going to be? How bad is it? Can I report to you that my power is out?
Yeah, it's but, you know, it's, when you look at it, we're kind of used to this. And even though we grumble and complain, we get through it. But we have to, when you look at all these places that get unexpected snow and ice, and they don't have plows.
Snow tires.
It's just amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
You forget that driving in snow is an art, and that it's something that you've learned to do, and that if you've never really driven even a quarter inch of snow, if you don't know how to drive in it, it's really disruptive.
Absolutely. Nice story about Fairfield Farm Sustainable Agriculture.
Right. Lila Hawken covered, and we love it, on Zoom. A nice talk by Amy Sidrin. And I think that anybody who lives in this region drives by Fairfield Farm all the time. It's on that stretch of Route 41 where the Sharon and Salisbury borders meet. And it's this beautiful big farm. It was a beautiful farm when it was owned by Jack Blum for many years. And then he's a Hotchkiss alumnus. He passed along that property and a conservation easement to the Hotchkiss School. And it seemed in the beginning like, you know, it was going to be sort of a novelty, and that occasionally they would, you know, sell some potatoes or serve some salads at the school. But they're really doing a lot of production, partly under the guidance of Alan Cockerline from Whippoorwill Farm in Salisbury. But Amy really talks about the thousands and thousands of pounds of food that they're producing, not just for the dining hall, but also for our local food pantry. So really a wonderful use of a local agricultural asset.
Now, Hotchkiss doesn't take on tasks lightly, and they involve the students in everything so heavily. I'm always amazed when I speak to the students that are there and the administrators, how anybody has time for anything, and Hotchkiss is amazing.
Yeah.
Cornwall, P&Z, their forum on the 10-year plan of development.
I always say, like a broken record, the town plan of conservation and development is the most important document that every town comes up with, because it determines what your town is going to look like. It's the basis for the planning and zoning regulations. So Cornwall takes it very seriously. The state requires towns to update their town plan every 10 years. They've just completed this round of the town plan. They're already starting to plan for their next one in 10 years. And, of course, what they'll do next is they'll go into the planning and zoning regulations and they'll begin to adapt. But most of the towns are fairly consistent in saying they don't want light industry. They want large plots or residential properties, and they want to retain the rural charm and beauty of our area.
And under that, the Swift House and speeding was a discussion in Kent.
Yeah, Swift House is a town-owned building and had really fallen into disuse, and, you know, Lila kind of obliquely refers to it, but there was a lot of rodents living in the building. And it had been a building that was available for a lot of town uses. So they finally are taking a moment now. And I think that, like, you know, I don't know this, but this indicates to me that this means there's a little bit of extra wiggle room in the budget. And, of course, we're moving into budget season now. And, you know, we'll see how towns did. But if anything good can come out of the COVID quarantine, let's hope that towns are able to save a little bit of money and then put it into things like Swift House that are essential, but that maybe fall fairly low on the list.
All right. The triangle traffic plan and the human element.
So this is that little triangle over at Route 7. Not when you pass the historic cover bridge, but the concrete bridge that connects Sharon and Cornwall that I think people maybe don't even realize they're crossing as they go. There's a little gas station, Richard Bramwell's liquor store. And that's really in a more of a town green than you realize it is for Cornwall. This is where they have the Black Lives Matter protest. This is where they have their Christmas tree. And so the state, those are state highways that create that triangle there. And so the state is coming in and saying, we think we're going to redo how the traffic goes there. And people in town are saying, actually, we'd like to have some say in this because it is a place that's used by a lot of people. Let's make sure that it's safe and that it suits our needs as well as the state's.
Well, it's interesting how the green has changed in the past 10 years, because you now have a very active grocery store, and also the senior affordable housing that's there. So there are a lot of people that cross around that area now, and besides the automobile traffic, there is a lot more human traffic around there than there ever was.
Right.
All right. I liked it. The ice finally got in at Lakeville Lake.
It went in, but I was snowshoeing with my friend Ann yesterday around the edges of the lake, and it's starting to, you know, soften up a little bit. And when you're out on that lake, it makes the most extraordinary noises, as though there were the Loch Ness Monster were under the water and had just eaten some spicy food. It's very kind of blurpy, not really cracky, but a reminder to everybody, just because the ice is in, it doesn't mean that there aren't soft spots. So don't go out into the center of those lakes unless you are really experienced with the ice here. And make sure you bring your ice picks, because people do fall through almost every year in one of these water bodies.
As a kid, I used to hate to go out ice skating. We had a pond that did the same thing. Once it got frozen over, the noise, it was almost like whales and screech.
Yeah.
It really was. And my brothers and sisters would go out there in the evening. I wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got a great picture essay about the Salisbury Winter Sports Association, but also another pretty big guy in our area has passed away, and that is, of course, Ron Jones.
Ron Jones, and he and Ed Kirby, who passed away about a week ago, really very linked, the two of them, big historians, really active guys. Tom Schachtman has a story, a little appreciation he wrote for next week, in which he says Ron Jones is a fireman, and if he joined your nonprofit board, you knew that whatever needed to get done was going to get done. An amazing guy, worked very closely with Ed Kirby in not only reviving the Beckley Furnace, which is a big historic site around here, but Ron was essential to the creation of this region as a federal heritage area. Really lovely guy, very courtly. He used to be in our office, I swear, about once a week visiting with Janet. He'd come in his tracksuit and gracious, elegant, smart. So, again, a big loss to the region, both him and Ed Kirby, and, of course, Ro Chinnati about 6 months ago.
Yeah, all right. We want to go on to the opinion and editorial page. First of all, we'll start off with the editorial, Janet, celebrating an iconic resource in Cornwall.
Right. It's amazing to think that a little town paper could survive for 30 years, but the Cornwall Chronicle is indeed celebrating its 30th anniversary, and it's really been an extraordinary publication for this town. And it's all our towns are unique, but Cornwall has three separate hamlets that really do need to have communication happen. And 30 years ago, the idea to start up this town paper really made a difference, I think, to the way Cornwall has remained cohesive. And, you know, now we have the internet, we have different ways that the towns stay in touch, but that chronicle, you know, people still love to see it show up, and they read it online, and it's a great resource. And we talk about, the way Cornwall has evolved and continues to have sort of a bit of a renaissance in West Cornwall now, and Cornwall Bridge has been active all along, as you were pointing out, Marshall. It's a great little town, and congratulations to all the writers, all those volunteers, professionals of all kinds, putting out that Cornwall Chronicle once a month for 30 years.
And I am just blown away by the letters. You've got letters on two different letters, one on the Nature Conservancy explaining that. Also, Tim Abbott with a very good response on land trust and other letters. I mean, those letters continue to come in during this cabin fever time.
It is, and people are taking their time and really thinking about what they want to say. So we're glad to have the letter from Tim talking about trusting land trust, because we did have a letter questioning that, and he gives all the reasons why you can trust them. We do have another letter from the Nature Conservancy, Andrew Benson, on their position in talking about land trusts and the conservation easements. And we also, as Cynthia mentioned, Eric Mason is writing about Salisbury residents deserving transparency, and he talks about the Northwest Council of Governments quite a bit. A couple more that really have great ideas and get you thinking. So let them read them, think about it, and write us a letter.
Peter Riva with results from a political trial, the domestic terrorism threat is not Antifa. I mean, this is one page that hasn't slowed down with the winter months, Janet.
No, and you know that's because our lives haven't really slowed down. There's a lot to think about and write about, and our readers do that, so we're grateful for that.
All right, and Cynthia, we can take a look, of course, at the next segment.
Unexpectedly, still so much activity in the arts going on around here, and as people get better and better with Zoom, more and more stuff. So Fred Baumgarten writing about Yehuda Hanani and Close Encounters with Music, which, you know, I probably don't know as much about classical music as I ought to, and I think that Yehuda Hanani is probably one of these treasures that we have up here, a super beautifully trained musician, very thoughtful, who really wants to bring classical music to us and teach us about it. And Fred Baumgarten interviews him about an upcoming concert about cello music by Bach. that makes you feel like, oh, it's so accessible. I get it. I want to do it. David Anthone, who I think people around here know as part of Darn Studio, which is, I would say, a fairly radical art duo, really doing interesting work, very social justice. And I was surprised to discover that he's a state historic preservation officer, which is a very unexpected combination of two sides of his personality. And so he'll be doing a talk on public monuments for the Litchfield Historical Society that is going to be really interesting, because here's a guy who's into, like, breaking down historic patterns, and yet it's also his job to preserve it. And, you know, public monuments are a really big issue right now for all of us to be thinking about. The winter weekend in Cornwall, in Norfolk, is coming up. Lots of stuff going on, most of it going on online. And beekeeping. Everybody I know loves beekeeping around here. It's one of those things that people love to do when they move up to the country. Some people become very good at it. It's not that easy. Bees are even more complicated than making bread. So two different sets of talks coming up with a lot of in-depth information. One of them starts tonight. I think it's 6 o'clock. Information on how to log on to those on our website. AJ Croce, I love Jim Croce. I think I assume that everybody else does. I'm not sure that they do, but you know, he was alive at a time. He recorded just a couple of albums before he died in a plane crash. There's not a lot of him on the internet, and it turns out that he has a son who's a musician and does beautiful music, and sounds like his father, but is much more interesting even than. You know, in his life, he's much older than his father had been. He's had a lot of tragedy in his life. He brings a lot to his music, and so he's doing two concerts for the Mahaley. I've been listening to him on Spotify. It's very beautiful, very moving, but also very fun. And then the Ripley Waterfowl Conservancy in Litchfield, a really wonderful organization that we have a link to through one of our advisors, Gavin Berger. And they have these incredible birds there called Siberian cranes. And as a fundraiser, they're offering people the chance to name them. So you can watch them on a video at the Ripley website at South Compass.
All right. That is our look at the Lakeville Journal this week, of course, available on newsstands, home delivery, and online at tricornernews.com. Guys, we'll speak to you next week. Hopefully there won't be any snow.
Yeah, there'll be something.
All right, take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.
That is This Week in the Lakeville Journal. Once again, you can find them on the web, tricornernews.com.